Welcome to your commercial-free, uninterrupted investment show, sponsored by the SEC-registered investment firm, Wilsey Asset Management, a fiduciary firm owned and operated by President Brent Wilsey, who has been putting clients' investment needs first for over 40 years. The Smart Investing Show has been giving unbiased financial information for over 27 years on local radio stations right here in San Diego, providing you with fundamental analysis on stocks and investments you want to know about. Now, here are your hosts, Brent and Chase Wilsey.
All righty, welcome to the Smart Investing Show. I'm Chase Wilsey, and I'll be your host here for the next, we'll call it hour or so. As you may have noticed, yes, I'll be the host. Brent is not here today, so with me we do have our financial planner, Harrison Johnson. Harrison, how are we doing today?
Doing well. Always good to be in the studio.
We always love having you. Great guest. I know a fan favorite, I'm sure.
Yeah, that's what people tell me all the time. So, you know, you're welcome. I'm back again.
Well, we got a good show for you here today. A lot of economic news impacting the market. So we'll get into the GDP, the gross domestic product. Also talk about the Fed's preferred gauge for inflation, which is the PCE, or the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index. We'll also talk about the S&P 500. I know a lot of people kind of lean into this as an index fund, and I'm kind of point out some things that worries me a little bit in terms of valuation and kind of the index's components at this time. So we'll talk about that. And then also back half of the show, as you know, we like to cover some different stocks that are kind of prevalent in the news at this point in time. Today we're going to talk about Nordstrom. And I thought this would be an interesting one because the family did form a special committee there to kind of evaluate bids to go private. Also too, Netflix reported earnings last week. Some interesting news there. Now we should have good numbers on Netflix, so I wanted to wait until we had the updates there. Goldman Sachs is the last one I wanted to kind of take a look at as well. I still think financial companies are an intriguing place to be. I think M&A or mergers and acquisitions could potentially be picking up after some slowdown over the last couple years. So we'll take a closer look at those three companies. We have time. Maybe we'll take a look at another one. But with that, let's get into kind of, I'll say, the economic news here to start. So first, we're going to look at the GDP. First quarter GDP, well, it was a large disappointment as it grew at an annualized pace of 1.6%. That was substantially below the estimate of 2.4%. Now, I will say, considering there is a lot of data to collect, the first reading can be subject to major revisions. As a recent example, in 2023, Q1 GDP had an initial reading which showed an increase of 1.1%, but it was then revised upward later to 2.2%. I mean, that's a doubling, essentially. Oh, exactly, actually, from the initial reading. That's a huge, huge change. So don't think this initial reading is kind of it for first quarter GDP. There could be some changes, potentially down as well. You never know. So we'll see as that data kind of percolates and as we get more updated numbers. Now, given the current numbers we did get in the first introduction or the initial reading of GDP, I would still say there were some positives. Although it was below the estimate of 3% and down from the Q4 reading of 3.3%, consumer spending in the quarter still grew nicely with a gain of 2.4%. Again, people are still spending money. Even if it's slowing down, there's still money being spent in the economy. I will say there was quite a large discrepancy between goods and services spending, as goods actually fell 0.4% and services climbed 4%. I'm not surprised with all the people going out to restaurants. Gosh, we went to a Padre game last week. I was blown away with the amount of people in the stadium.
It was packed. It was unbelievable. And it was really hot, too.
It was so hot, and there was nowhere to move. I mean, it was insane. So I got to say, when I go places like that and people say, oh, the economy's not doing well, I'm like, well, there's definitely people still spending money. But the other thing, too, about services that I wanted to point out was that 4% decline, it marked the best quarter since Q3 2021. So even though goods is kind of pulling down the overall consumer spending, people are spending money on services very, very strongly. Good spending was largely dragged down by a 1.2% decline in durable goods. Also, private investment was also very strong in the quarter as it grew 3.2%. And residential investment was a large contributor to that number as it increased 13.9%.
Government spending was also positive in the quarter with a gain of 1.2%. With all these positives, you might be wondering how GDP missed expectations. Areas that were negative weights on the report include the change in private inventories, which subtracted 0.35% from the headline number, and net exports of goods and services, which subtracted 0.86% from the headline number. Private inventories can be a volatile metric that will depend on business inventories restocking themselves. We wouldn't be surprised to see this number turn positive in Q2, considering Q4 of 2023 and this last Q1 of 2024 was also negative and subtracted 0.47% from the headline number. This followed a nice benefit of 1.27% in Q3 of 2023. If consumer spending remains strong, businesses will likely need to restock inventory, which should be a benefit moving forward. As for the trade imbalance, this came as exports grew 0.9% in the quarter, but imports rose 7.2%. Overall, we wouldn't say this report was super strong, but it's also not worried about the, you know, we're not worried about the current standing of the economy as we're still anticipating a slowdown relative to a major recession.
Yeah, I mean, this is just so important because there's so many numbers that comes out in the GDP report. Obviously, just the headline number doesn't tell the full story. And I mean, the private inventories, it's one that, again, can be a very hefty weight if you don't look at it closely. And all of a sudden, you might have the opposite here. This would be a problem where the consumer's only maybe spending's up 0.5%, but all of a sudden they restocked a bunch of inventories and adds 1% of GDP. Now you had a 1.5% growth, of course, all else equal of GDP, but that's not a strong GDP report. I think this is kind of the opposite, obviously. The consumer still having growth over 2%, I don't think it's bad.
Yeah, and I mean, you kind of pointed out, Chase, with these types of reports, there's so many different numbers that are made out to them. I mean, we're talking about here 2.2, 2.4, 1.2, 3.9. I mean, it's all numbers, but it's helpful to take a step back and compare them quarter to quarter to quarter, and it really kind of points out on that inventory number. Q3 was positive, Q4 was down, Q1 was down. This next quarter, too, I mean, those things, with being as volatile as they are, over time, they should level themselves out. And, you know, we might get some lift on that in the next quarter report.
And I'm still in the camp or a believer here that I think GDP growth, we're not going to get, I think, sustained 3% plus growth on GDP, but I still think we can register around a 2% level. And again, the consumer is a large part of that. I'm going to say the rest is going to be noise in between government spending, imports, exports, also to the business inventories. I mean, that's going to be outside noise, but I think we can still see that consumer generating about 2% growth and maybe over the next year or so, and we'll have to see as numbers change and develop. But I still see plenty of strength in the consumer over the next 12, 18, 24 months.
Especially when you look at the service side of that, too. I mean, we're shifting more and more to a service-type economy, and I think those numbers are just going to continue to grow. And I wonder how much of the benefit that the service numbers that we're seeing are kind of a shift from the goods to that, because so many companies now are implementing, you know, monthly type subscription models as opposed to a goods model. And so, you know, naturally we'll see those service numbers just continue to increase, I think.
Yeah, I mean, that's a good point. I mean, just very simplistically, obviously, like Uber, mm-hmm. You know, I'm not saying a lot of people don't have cars, but if, again, more people started to say, I'm just good Ubering, well, you're not going to buy a car, you're just going to use the service instead. So that's a great point to consider is, you know, how is that changing the economy and how much more are we going to see in services growth? I think it's very strong, and I still think there's plenty of room for, you know, travel. I think people are still traveling like crazy too.
That's where Brent is right now.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I also want to talk about here as well. This has been a big mover, obviously, in the stock market with inflation. And what I'm talking about is the Personal Consumption Expenditures Index, or the PCE. And in the release for the March numbers, the PCE index, or I should say the core PCE, it was lackluster, to say the least. It wasn't as positive as I was hoping for, but I still don't think it was that bad. The core PCE of 2.8% came in slightly hotter than the estimate of 2.7%, but it matched February's number, and including food and injury, PCE increased 2.7%, which was also slightly higher than the estimate of 2.6%.
Services continues to elevate prices as they were up 4% on a 12-month basis versus goods, which increased just 0.1%. So that's kind of that thing we were just talking about. Overall, it is somewhat disappointing to see the deceleration of this inflation, but numbers don't always follow a straight line trajectory, which is, again, important to understand. It will be interesting to see this report over the next couple months, but as of now, the estimate for 3 rate cuts is maybe a little bit more questionable.
Yeah, and I mean, the thing here, obviously, is we've gotten somewhat lucky, or not lucky, but very used to seeing, you know, the prior month PCE being, you know, 3% and 2.8%. So we've seen kind of a month after month a decline in the PCE, core PCE, I should say, month over month, where we just haven't seen that now for the February number to March number. It was flat. And it seems like people are like, oh my gosh, it was one report at the end of the day. And yeah, we haven't seen the same type that we saw, you know, coming out of, you know, the craziness that we saw with major inflation, where inflation spiked up to 6% and then all of a sudden, yeah, it got cut down to, you know, 4% very quickly. But we are getting close to that 2% level the Fed talks about. I mean, sometimes too, I think it is just silly, like 2%, why?
You know, it's very low.
Well, I mean, it's low, but also, why is it 2%, not 2.5%, not 1.5%? I mean, is there any, and I haven't done the research, I haven't seen this, why is 2% the target level?
Yeah, and I mean, it's as you get closer to it, it gets more and more difficult to hone into it. It's one thing to go from 6% to 3%, but then 3% down to 2%, things really have to slow. And, you know, with, you know, people out there spending money like they are, there's still going to be some of that, those numbers that keep that a little bit elevated.
And I still believe there's a lot of anomalies out there. I mean, I was on CNBC this morning. They talked about how the number of areas that are up more than 5% year over year is just much higher than what it was pre-COVID. But what that tells me is then we should have some normalization, which as things normalize, then next year we might not have as many things that are distorting the report, and we could get closer to that 2% level. But overall, I still think that the Fed, just the way they've been talking and, you know, the three rate cuts, I'm not saying that they should do three rate cuts, but I just don't think they will. I think that three rate cuts could still make sense if inflation were to, let's say, tick down to around the 2.5% level. I don't see why they wouldn't be able to cut rates, but the way this Fed's been talking, I just don't think we'll get three based off a lot of the headlines from them. And again, it was 1 month of inflation data, but we'll kind of have to see as time progresses.
Yeah, and I mean, with the language that they've been saying recently, I mean, now if we do see a rate cut, it's not going to start for potentially another couple months, where at the end of last year, they were pricing in that it was going to start by March, which, yeah, you know, that came and went. Now June's probably not going to happen either. So three rate cuts, yeah, maybe not. But again, and with the Fed, they want to be slow as opposed to fast. And, you know, they've made every indication that that's the way that they're going to look at this thing. And yeah, maybe it's not going to be three.
Yeah, it frankly shouldn't change your investment philosophy or change your decisions there. But it's just something to kind of prepare yourself for, obviously. Speaking of investing, let's turn to kind of some thoughts on the S&P 500. While it remains expensive based on several valuation metrics, that doesn't mean you can't find buys out there. Although the index trades around 20 times forward earnings, about 20% of companies are bringing up that multiple as they trade at double the index's valuation. The positive is there's about 20% of the index that trades at half the index's multiple.
Much of the dislocation comes from the excitement over growth stocks, and the index now has more than two times the allocation towards growth at 46% over value now at 21%. Historically, the allocation has been much more balanced, and actually on average over the last 30 years, the split has been an allocation of 31% growth but 32% value. So usually the allocation is more towards the value side with that allocation in the S&P. We continue to believe that numbers like these will be a reason for values outperformance going forward.
I mean, I've talked about this before, but it's just, you know, if you've been in the S&P, you've been in the NASDAQ, you've done very well over the last, I'm going to say 10, 15 years. But historically, I mean, value is a very good place to be investing. And the S&P 500, people call it a blended approach because it's supposed to be growth and value. It's kind of losing that aspect of it as growth is becoming more and more of it. I don't really think you can call it a blended approach anymore because, again, almost 50% of it is in growth stocks. And again, value only is about 20%. I mean, that's a huge discrepancy. It is definitely more growth than blended, I would say, at this point in time.
And I mean, at what point, this is an index, but it's not, it's almost not even an index at this point, because an index is supposed to be a range of a lot of different companies and to give you a, you know, an idea of the market as a whole. But the S&P, it's really comprised of just a few companies. And when you take those out, the performance is totally different.
Yeah, I mean, kind of to that point, we'll look at this here, but I mean, we've talked about the concerns of over-concentration in the index. The technology has just become such a big part of it, and the sector actually controls about 30% of the entire index. But the crazy thing is Amazon, Tesla, Meta, and Alphabet, well, they're actually classified as consumer and communication stocks, which would then understate the tech weighting of the S&P 500 because they're not part of that 30% weighting. And I put in here as well, of course, well, do you count Tesla as a technology company? The way it trades in terms of multiples, absolutely, it should be classified as a technology company because it's not trading like an auto manufacturer, that's for sure. So, I mean, the tech-focused companies, I guess I'll put it, is just such a large component. And I mean, if those companies were included, again, the weighting would be over 40% in the tech and tech-like names. Now, the last time the index was so concentrated in tech occurred before the dot-com bubble burst in 2000.
If you've held the Magnificent Seven over the last couple years, congrats. But for those who enjoyed the movie The Magnificent Seven, you may remember four of the seven ended up dead. Could we see a similar fate with these stocks? I didn't write that part, but
big movie buff over here.
I actually haven't seen that movie, but it's pretty clever. The Magnificent Seven. I think it's on Netflix, right? Yeah,
I think so. I mean, it's just, you know, it was something that I think is a very real possibility. I don't think any of the Magnificent Seven, at least in the next 5 years, I couldn't see them going bankrupt.
No.
But I can absolutely see them struggling in terms of stock performance, which would cause some problems. And I mean, talking about the Magnificent Seven, I mean, these companies, again, Microsoft, Apple, NVIDIA, Amazon, Meta, Google, and Tesla, I mean, currently make up about 30% just themselves of the S&P 500. So again, that means seven companies, about 30%, 493 companies, about 70%. I'll let you do the math on that. I mean, you break that down, it's a very, very small allocation of the remaining 493 companies. And even the NASDAQ's crazier, the QQQ, the NASDAQ 100, the Magnificent Seven now makes up about 40% of the NASDAQ 100. So, I mean, if you're in these indexes, you just got to be mindful of these things because you've done very well, but now will you do well going forward is the question. Can these companies continue to go crazy like they have?
And again, it's getting to the point where, is this really an index or is this seven companies and everything else is kind of just along for the ride? Because even if one of those companies struggles for any type of reason, that will have a significant impact on the index, we'll call it, as a whole. So, you know, you have to separate, well, what has the historical return been of this versus what caused it to do that? And what's it really going to look like going forward? Because, you know, as we know, historical performance doesn't dictate future returns. And so if you're somebody who's like, yep, I'm just going to play it safe and invest in the S&P, well, you might as well just invest in those seven companies because that's essentially what the S&P is at this point.
Yeah. And I mean, if you have invested in the seven companies, obviously you've done very well. But again, what's going to happen going forward? And I mean, kind of to your point, we did have one more little section on numbers here, just kind of how impactful these companies have been. And I tell people, I mean, if you didn't do as well in the market in 2023, don't beat yourself up. The reason is the top 10 stocks greatly carried both the S&P 500 and the NASDAQ. In fact, the average return for the top 10 stocks was 85.6% versus 16% for the other 490 companies.
I mean, that's in itself is just crazy. The top 10 stocks, about 86% versus only 16% return from the other 490 companies. So this meant that those top stocks accounted for 63% of the index's return for the year. Over the past 30 years, the top 10 stocks have on average represented 24% of the index growth. And right now, again, it's 63. So we continue to worry many of these top 10 stocks could be a drag on the index and people's portfolios considering their lofty valuations.
I mean, just kind of, again, the thing about this conceptually is the index was up, you know, what, 20-something percent last year. And the fact that those top 10 stocks were up 85% meant 63% of that 20% gain just came from those 10 stocks. So you take out those 10 stocks, you're not having a 20% gain. And for our listeners, you probably know we didn't own any of those top 10 stocks. We do value investing. And I'll tell you, it hurt us in 2023. But that's not what you're looking at. You can't look at those types of numbers as an investor and looking at a one-year return, because if you're trying to time one-year returns, you're never going to be successful in investing. You have to look at what's going to happen going forward over the next 5, 10, 15 years. And sometimes, I'll tell you, you're going to be wrong. I mean, value has been out of favor for the last 10 years. But just because that's the case, what's going to happen over the next 10 years? Is value going to be in favor? We're going to look back 10 years from now and be like, yep, the S&P's averaged 4% per year, but value's averaged 10% per year. That's a very real possibility. It's always so easy to call it after the game's over. But the problem is the game essentially is now just beginning for the next decade.
Yeah. And I mean, it's when you look at it like that, when you invest over the long term, you want to have the highest potential chance to have returns with the least amount of risk. And again, these indexes are really just a couple companies, so they're not well diversified. They will live and die as those companies do. And with the valuations that they have, you're paying a lot for those revenue numbers and those earnings numbers. And since now they have make up such a large percentage of these indexes, they don't even have to go down. They could
not go up.
They could not go up. They could be stagnant, and that will have a huge impact on the return. So you could have, you know, 95% of companies out there do really well, but you could have these companies do nothing and earn nothing, and now your returns are going to be bad because, again, the huge weighting of them is preventing growth from those indexes going forward.
And I'll tell you, they could go higher, but many of them trade over 30 times earnings. I don't see... Especially you talk about an 85% gain in the top 10 last year. I don't see that repeating itself this year. That's I'm pretty confident about that.
Yeah, I mean, at some point these already actually some of these companies have market caps that are larger than like some countries out there. I mean, are these things going to just totally take over the world? And mean, I mean, 86% return is that's unsustainable long term. And again, investing should be looked at from a long term perspective.
Yeah, absolutely. So again, just be careful. You got to understand what you own. That's what we always tell our clients is understand what's in your portfolio. And just because, oh, I own the S&P. Well, what does that actually mean? That's what I just kind of wanted to point out for you, for our listeners here today. Next up, I do want to turn to Harrison, obviously here in studio today, but talking about his financial planning topic. I thought this was a great one, kind of talking about taxation in terms of cash. And the big question, do you hold too much cash in your portfolio? In the bank. I'll take it away, Harrison.
Yeah, I had fun kind of looking at this and writing this. I met with somebody this week that is a radio show listener, so they might be out there, that inspired me to talk about this. But everyone needs some level of cash, and that number varies from person to person. For those with higher levels of assets, it can be possible to have too much cash, which should instead be better off invested. We've seen people with $100,000, $250,000, $500,000, or even over $1 million in cash, which is likely way too much, even if it's in a high-yield account or a CD or something like that. Over time, cash will not perform as well as invested dollars. Right now, there's places where cash can earn over 5%, but this is still lower than market returns of 8 to 10% or more. Also, those 5% yields will be coming down as interest rates decline, which that will happen at some point. We know there's people out there who wait to time the market and invest their cash right at the bottom, but generally that doesn't work out and it's difficult to do consistently. But also from a tax perspective, cash produces interest, which is taxed at a higher rate than investment income like dividends or capital gains. When interest is taxed at 10 or 12%, investment income would be taxed at 0%. When interest is taxed at 22, 24, or 32% in those brackets, investment income would be taxed at 15%. Not only is cash taxed at a higher rate, but also its entire return is reportable as income every year. There's no appreciation in cash. So for example, if you have $500,000 of cash earning 5% for a total of $25,000, that entire $25,000 is reportable as interest income that year. If instead that $500,000 was invested in equities earning on average, let's say 8%, but that 8% is 2% dividends and 6% appreciation, you would only need to report that 2% dividend income, which would be $10,000 on the $500 that you have, as long as nothing is sold. So this flexibility keeps your tax bill down, but also reduces the chance of triggering AGI-related issues like the net investment income tax or additional Medicare premiums or things like that. So, for example, if you're in the fourth tax bracket with an 8% investment return, again, on $500,000, so that'd be $40,000 return. If you're only, you'd only really have to pay $1,500 in federal taxes if those dividends are the only income that you had to report on that. Plus, on the state side, if you're in California, $930. So, $500K invested, you make 8%, which is $40,000. But of that 40, only 10 is from dividends. So, you're reporting the dividends on your taxes, $1,500 federal taxes plus $930 on the state side. If you compare that with a, let's say, 5% cash return on that same amount of money, $25,000 now, you would have $6,000 in ordinary income taxes on the federal side, $2,325 in state taxes, plus you could potentially have an extra $570 net investment income tax, and or maybe another $3,000 in extra Medicare premiums. So now that 5% yield becomes 2.6% after tax, while those invested dollars, still taxable, but at a much lower rate and a much lower level, at a 7.5% after tax return. So investing can be volatile in the short term, but over time, it's a much better option rather than hoarding too much cash.
You know, this was just such a great topic. And, you know, if the numbers did get a little bit kind of complicated for you, we do post these on our website. So if you go to smartinvesting2000.com, our newsletters, you can kind of see the breakdown on the numbers here. Just to get an idea, because it is so important to understand that, yeah, I'm getting a 5% yield and it's great and I don't have to take on any risk. But again, you have to take in the tax impact of that. And people just hate volatility so much. And it just... I want to say it drives me crazy, but I just find it so interesting where, you know, look, 5-10 years down the road, you don't care how volatile something was after it's all over. You're just happy that you got to that end goal by the time that comes, essentially. The volatility, it's hard to go through at times, but it's worth it in the long term.
It absolutely is worth it. And that doesn't mean you can invest all the cash that you have. Again, everyone needs some level of cash, but we see all the time out there where people have way too much cash, or they're very happy with their 5% yield that they get on a savings account. No volatility in that, but again, all 5% is reportable as income. It's taxed at a higher rate. That can cause other AGI related problems where, you know, if you look at something that's going to produce capital gains that you don't have to pay taxes on until you sell, dividends at a lower level paying, again, taxed at a lower rate. There's so much that goes into that. Not just on the growth perspective, but on the tax perspective as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, thanks for bringing that up, Harrison. Some great points there and some great thoughts to consider. And again, Harrison looks at all these different things as a CFP. You want to set a time with him, go to smartinvesting2000.com. We'll take a quick break and we'll be right back. Alrighty, welcome back to the second half of the Smart Investing Show. It's that time. We're going to take a closer look at some companies that have been quite prevalent in the news over the last, I'd say, a couple weeks. First one I want to get to today was actually Nordstrom, and their ticker symbol is JWN. And this one just always intrigued me. I kind of talked a little bit at the beginning of the show here, but the company actually formed a special committee to evaluate bids to go private. And one thing that I've known is this company is still quite largely family owned. I'm not quite sure exactly how much of the shares outstanding it is, but I remember several years ago the company always said, well, if it goes lower, you know, we'd consider taking it private. Well, as that time now come, because the stock still has not done well, I've always thought there could maybe be a potential backstop to this company falling if it goes low enough and turning to the family to take it private. With that said, though, you never want to buy a company just because they might get bought or they might go private, because if it doesn't happen and they're a poor company, well, you have no fundamental reason for holding it. But sometimes, I mean, if the numbers make sense and that opportunity is there, it could be a nice, I'll say, safety net. But with that, before we make any determination on buying it just because of that information, let's take a closer look again at the numbers for Nordstrom. Their ticker symbol, again, JWN. Nice large short percentage of the float out there, 14.5%. Obviously, department stores have been struggling, especially kind of even pre-COVID. The department stores have taking it on the chin from people like Amazon. Institutional ownership, just 54.8%. Again, I'd be curious how much of the stock out there the family currently owns. I don't believe there's any different voting class or anything, so the family still, I guess, would own a good chunk of just the normal shares outstanding. Turning to the valuations, a little disappointed here. Price to earnings 23.3 versus an industry average of 16.1. Price to sales do look good at 0.2, half the industry is 0.4. Price to tangible book value also strong at 5.2, below the industry average of 6.7. And price to cash flow looks great at 5, below the industry at 6.1. You do have a PEG ratio going forward at 1.9. That's an attractive multiple. Very strange on the earnings growth. Over the last 1 year, down 45.7%, while the industry was about flat up 0.7. And sales during that time period, they declined 5.4% when the industry was up 4.2. I'd be really curious on the earnings side of the equation as to how those earnings fell. Were those some one-time expenses that maybe came in? Because to have sales only go down 5 versus earnings falling 45%, that's a huge discrepancy. You got to understand what happened there in the quarter for the year. I mean, that would maybe make an exception for that high PE multiple. 5-year estimated earnings growth going forward, about 6.8%. So you are looking for earnings growth on this company. I'm a little bit surprised by that, to be honest. Looking at the dividend, nice dividend here for the company, a 4% yield, but the payout ratio is 91.6%. As I said, those earnings were one-time expenses that occurred in the quarter for the year. That payout ratio would naturally come down as earnings normalize, and potentially that payout ratio could look okay. But 4% dividend, that's a nice bonus for a company. Turning to the balance sheet, this is one thing I know that's always troubled me with Nordstrom. The current ratio looks okay at 1, below the industry average of 1.3, but debt to equity, 530%, well above the industry average of 150%. I have never known why Nordstrom has carried so much debt on the balance sheet, and it's always been something that frankly has kept me out of the stock for many, many years. It's just that debt never seems to become comfortable for me. I just would never buy a company that had a debt to equity of 530%. Looking at the net margin, 0.9%. Again, stemming from some question on expenses, that is well below the industry average of 2.1%. Strong return on equity of 15.8%, and return on invested capital 4.3%. Looking at the current price for Nordstrom, it is $19.13. The 52-week high is $23.53, and the low here, $12.88. That came in November 13th of last year. Year to date, I see the stock's up about 4.9%. I know they got a nice little bump after announcing the special committee to evaluate going private. But I mean, just the long-term returns have been atrocious. The last 3 years, down 44%. Last 5 years, down 46%. Last 10 years, down 56%. So, I mean, Nordstrom stock has definitely been struggling. But as always, we do want to look at what could happen here going forward. I go out to January 2026. I do see estimated earnings per share here of $1.90. If we take that $1.90 and multiply it by our 16.6 multiple, we do get a target sell price of $31.54. I mean, that is attractive compared to the current price again of $19.13. Trades at a forward PE multiple of around 10 times. So the valuations are good. You get a decent dividend. The potential is there for the company to go private, where you might get a nice 20-30% premium, a 40% premium if the company did go private. But again, the big thing that I just got to be honest with you, keep me out of the stock, is that debt level is just too much for me to even consider stepping into a company like Nordstrom.
I mean, also when you look at whenever there's something with a chance to go private, it makes it so volatile. I mean, you can have days where it's up a lot and then days it's down a lot. And so on the one side, you know, you have the risk of buying the stock, because if they come out and say, okay, we're not going to buy it, you could see a fall. But also with the short that they have on that, that's also something that I wouldn't necessarily want to short, because you could lose a lot of money very quickly if, you know, a deal does go through and that causes the stock price to jump really quickly.
Yeah, it always amazes me when shorts are that heavy on something that, as you said, can turn around and go up very quickly, because you could lose 30, 40, 50% just like that in a day if the deal does go through. So I mean, it's a huge risk.
It seems to be common with other companies like that, though, where there's negotiations of a potential merger or a buyout or something, and it's like, you got to have a lot of conviction to be shorting something like that.
What do you think you know is the question. Well, so I hope that helps on Nordstrom there. Let's turn to Netflix. I mean, this was another one that obviously it was part of the FANG stocks. Didn't make the Magnificent Seven fame, though, but it did recover quite nicely over the last couple years. Let's look at the numbers here again. The short percentage of float, not much for Netflix, just 1.9%. Institutional ownership, 84.7%. Surprised it's that high, honestly. I thought there'd be a little bit more of a retail crowd for Netflix. Valuations, I'm just going to say ugly. Price to earnings, 39. Industry is not material. They're in the entertainment industry. Price to sales, 7.2, well above the industry average of 1.9. The price to book value, 11.3, again, substantially above the industry average of 2.7. Price to cash flow, 34.3, close to double the industry average of 17.5. Now, the PEG ratio, analysts are expecting a lot of growth for Netflix. Frankly, I'm not quite sure where it's going to come from, but the PEG ratio, 1.2, as they're looking for a five-year estimated growth rate on earnings of 25.8%. I got to question that number. I don't see how Netflix can grow earnings 25%. I haven't dug down deep into the weeds and looked through it, but I mean, that'd be a huge earnings growth rate over the next 5 years. Speaking of earnings growth, over the last 1 year, it was up 29%. They have cracked down again on the password sharing and kind of implemented some other initiatives to really drive margins. But I got to say, a lot of that's now in the past. What can they do again to replicate that going forward? Company did focus nicely on margins, though, as sales were only up 5%, while earnings increased again 29%. So a lot of margin there, which is a positive for the business. No dividend for Netflix. Balance sheet still looks good for the company. Current ratio 1.1. Debt to equity 0.7 or 70%. Not too much debt there, and the industry is at 90%. Looking at the profit margin for Netflix, 16%, well above the industry average of 2.1%. Return on equity, very strong, 26% versus the industry average of 7.2. And return on invested capital, 17.2 versus the industry average of 9.7. Now, current price for Netflix is $561.23. The 52-week high, wow, I didn't know it was off this much. The 52-week high was $639, came on April 8th. 52-week low, $315.62, came on May 2nd of last year. Year-to-date, the stock's still up about 15.3%, even after some question marks after they reported earnings. More on that on just a second. But first, I want to turn to the valuations going forward. I go out to December 2025. I see estimated earnings per share here of $21.92. It gives us a target sell price of $363.87. So, I mean, the forward multiple, it's about a little bit over 25 times. Again, we sell something that hits 16.6. Netflix, even with a recent pullback, is still expensive. And it was an interesting earnings report. The reason they pulled back wasn't because of bad numbers necessarily, but they said they were going to stop reporting the number of subscribers that they had. And the reason this is so interesting, this is how Netflix stock traded for years. Oh, did they beat subscribers? Earnings didn't matter. They could lose money, but as long as subscribers were good, the stock would go up. Well, now you're kind of losing that focus of investors, and I think people kind of panicked over it. And I got to say, if they're pulling that out, why do you think that is? Probably because they don't think subscribers are going to grow that much anymore going forward.
Which also has a trouble with, well, what multiple should this be trading at? Because as you said, if it's trading off of subscriber growth and percentage growth over time, but now they're not going to disclose that, the information has got to gravitate more toward a performance or a profit multiple. And I mean, 25% profit growth seems really high. And so then if we see negative information about that where it might not be that high, that could also be a real big problem that would bring downward pressure on that.
Yeah, and I mean, I know a lot of people, do you still watch Netflix?
I was just going to say, my wife likes it because it seems like the only thing on there is murder documentaries.
Yeah.
There's always like, they're interviewing somebody about somebody's kid killed somebody, and that's like all that I see now.
That or reality TV, and I mean, frankly, if they can turn that platform into that, it's kind of funny because there's like Bravo and stuff like that. But if they can turn that platform, that is a way higher margin business than actually producing content.
Yeah.
And I almost wonder how much of their budget is shifted into stuff like, obviously, Love is Blind is a big one for them. I can't imagine the production for that is anywhere near it would be for like an action show or something.
Oh, yeah. Especially now with the action shows and the amount of money and the CGI and everything that goes into those things, I mean, it's so expensive. So the margins, those shows really got to pay off with a lot of views to make it worth it.
And I do know they've done some other things as well where they're also looking at owning the rights to stream the WWE. I know they also have the fight with Mike Tyson and was it one of the Paul brothers?
Jake Paul. I think it's Jake, yeah.
Which, again, I don't think is going to be a very expensive thing for them. So, I mean, Netflix is doing smart things, but where is that growth going to come from? And again, trading at more than 25 times earnings, you got to keep growing. And I think pulling the subscriber count is especially one reason the stock's done so well. I got to question if that stock can continue to expand from here. So, long story short, Netflix, I still would not be a buyer of it. It was funny when it pulled back a couple of years ago, I think in 2022, the numbers finally made sense in terms of evaluation, but then it shot right back up. So, you know, it would have made sense a couple of years ago, but now Netflix, again, too expensive. But I think, Frank, I think we're ready here for Robert to talk some real estate. So I think today it looks like we are talking about if now is the time to refinance and if that could be the right thing to do. So, Robert, you there with us?
Good morning, guys. How you doing?
Good morning. Doing well. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Appreciate it.
You a big Netflix guy?
Yeah. No, my wife is, but no, for the same reason, the murder mystery.
That's all it is. He says, he's like.
But anyways, not a Netflix fan club here. So we'll turn it to you to talk a little bit about refinancing. Is now the time to do so?
So most folks wouldn't think it is. And, you know, with the stresses in the world that we're all dealing with, I had a client just calling and ask a couple of questions, and that's what we're really good at. I mean, if it is, we'll tell you, and if it's not a good time, we'll tell you that too. This particular folks, they bought their house about 3 years ago. They put minimal down, so they had something called PMI. And since then, they had actually gone to a credit union and taken out a home equity line of credit. So they have that. And the PMI, and then on top of it, they had some credit card debt. And I asked them, why didn't we take the PMI off before? Well, the company that has their loan told them they had to wait for 5 years, which not the case. But we went through the numbers, ran it for them. We're saving about $1,000 a month net.
Oh, wow.
So, and, you know, and they have a 3.75% interest rate on their first, but by the time you put it all together and, you know, annualize the rates that they're paying on everything, it's a lot of money. So I don't want folks just to disqualify themselves because of their rate on their first. You know, there's a lot of other factors that come into the picture.
Yeah, I mean, obviously somebody comes to you with a 3% rate, no other debt, you'd probably say there's not much we can do, but
no, I would tell them go out and have a nice dinner.
Yeah, but congratulations.
You're right though. When you add in, you know, credit card debt being 25-27%, seconds right now, if they're variable, can, you know, get into the 10% or more in some case, and so
easily, yeah.
You know, when we look at refinances that happened in 2020 and 2021, you know, everyone was dropping rates down, and so there's a lot of people out there that says, oh, I can't refinance until I get to 3%. Well, that might not happen, but that doesn't mean you shouldn't refinance. There's other cases where it definitely can make sense. And in many cases, you don't really have to drop your rate much at all, especially if you're doing things like you're talking about, Robert.
It for this family, it was a game changer. $1,000 back into their budget really could help anyone, really.
Well, especially if they have credit card debt, you know, it's that $1,000 cash flow saving is huge in terms of making sure they don't rack up more credit card debt.
Exactly. Just don't go back and do it again. They got stuck in that trap where they had a few things that had happened and they needed to do some work on the car, and they were making their payments, everything. I mean, they can survive, but that's just what they're doing, is they're surviving. And so we took a lot of stress out of their life by doing this.
So if somebody's listening to this now, I mean, what's the kind of action here? What should they be thinking? It's like, oh, you know, maybe I should, you know, call Robert to talk about refinancing. I mean, who is this essentially right for at this point in time?
Well, and fortunately, we've had quite a few folks off the show give us a call. And anybody who's just not sure about their situation, like I said, we'll run through the numbers with you and we'll tell you if you're great, good for you. But we can also make other suggestions. A lot of folks right now, because of taxes and owing taxes, they're trying to figure that whole mess out. And, you know, they didn't maybe take enough out during the year. And So what do you do? Do I put it on a credit card? How does this work? Lines of credit. There's a lot of different options out there for folks, for sure.
And you said the right thing too there. We'll take a look at the numbers. Everything always comes down to the numbers. So if it makes sense, you know, here are some opportunities, here are some strategies that can help out. And if the numbers don't make sense, you know, you'll let them know that.
That's exactly what we do.
And I think last week you said you're not a mortgage broker, you're a mortgage banker. Is that the right term?
That is the right term. So mortgage brokers usually send their loans to me.
So I know one thing we just love working with you guys on is, again, it always starts with a conversation. I know it's your big tagline there, and it has to make sense from the numbers. So we greatly appreciate your insight there, Robert, and always enjoy working with you.
Enjoy some Netflix tonight, guys.
You too, Robert. Thanks, and have a good weekend.
Take care. Bye-bye now.
All right, bye now. Once again, that's Robert Behick. He is the president of Countywide Mortgage Lending. They're actually one of the top 100 mortgage companies in America since 2012. And Robert is one of the top 1% producing loan officers in the country. Again, they really, I think, do a great job putting the client first there and talking through the numbers and talking about different options. You want to give Robert a call. His phone number is 760-443-3821. Again, 760-443-3821. Or you can go to countywidemtg.com. That's countywidemtg.com.
Countywide Mortgage Lending is a division of Golden Empire Mortgage, Inc., NMLS number 1104585, licensed by the Department of Financial Protection and Innovation under the California Residential Mortgage Lending Act. Countywide Mortgage Lending is an equal housing lender and proud member of the BBB.
All righty. Well, next up, let's get into talking a little bit more about financial companies and, you know, talked a lot about growth versus value at the beginning of this show there. And one value sector is generally financial companies. And, you know, we've talked about some of the big banks before, but I haven't looked at Goldman Sachs in quite a while. Obviously, it's a well-known name. We know that mergers, acquisitions, they're kind of put on pause for a little bit, I'd say. But now it seems like, gosh, IPOs have, I'm not going to say they're booming, but they're definitely picking back up, as you've seen a lot more this year than you have over the past couple years. So Goldman Sachs, they benefit from, again, that kind of investment banking model. Goldman Sachs, the ticker symbol, obviously GS, short percentage of float here, 1.5%. Institutional ownership, 72.5%. Price to earnings at, I'm going to say, a little surprised by this. Price earnings multiple 16.7. The industry average here, it says 19.4, and they're in the industry of capital markets rather than like money center banks like a JP Morgan Chase or a Wells Fargo. It's a little bit different industry, but price earnings multiples definitely a little bit higher there. Price to sales 3 versus the industry average of 2.5. Price to tangible book value, that one does look attractive at 1.2, which is, I'm going to say, essentially half the industry average of 2.5. This is odd. No price to cash flow. I'd want to look through this. Obviously, financial companies, sometimes the numbers can be a little bit wonky in terms of the financial statements. The peg ratio, though, for the forward peg, 0.9, below the industry average of 2.3. Earnings per share over the last 1 year, down 18.6%. While sales were down 0.9%, be very curious going forward here again as this picks up, how much more can they get in terms of sales growth, earnings growth? Definitely something you'd want to understand if you were looking at Goldman. It's definitely trying to understand that business model that they have, because I see the 5-year estimated growth right here, 15.8%. And one thing about this type of investment banking is their earnings and sales are going to be a lot more volatile because it's kind of subject to the whims of the market versus perhaps a money center bank. So it's one thing that it's always, I don't want to say concerned me with Goldman, but it's made the business a little bit more complicated to understand. Looking at the dividend, you get a 2.6% dividend yield here. The company pays, payout ratio is 45.6%, so about 45.6% of their earnings go to the dividend is what that means. It's an okay yield, I would say. The balance sheet, always strange for financial companies, as I always talk about this, but you know, loans are assets for financial companies and deposits are liabilities. So it's a little bit of a more complicated picture. Debt to equity here shows 290%. That could be okay, but you'd have to, again, do the research on Goldman to make sure that the financial statements are fundamentally sound and the balance sheet there is strong. Looking at the net margin, 18.4%, above the industry average of 13.2%. Return on equity a little bit light at 6.8%, below the industry average at 8.5%. Current price for Goldman Sachs. It did hit a 52-week high, actually, yesterday. It closed at $427.57 for the day. 52-week low, $289.36. I see the year-to-date return up about 11.5%. So over the last 1 year, done very well, up over 30%. Or nearly 30%, I should say. The three-year return, 36%. Over the last 10 years, I mean, Goldman's, it's done quite well, actually. The last 10 years, about 221%. The S&P's up about 225% over that time frame. So Goldman has definitely kept up. Now, looking forward for Goldman Sachs, I go out to December 2025. I do see here estimated earnings per share of $39.92. So again, we take our 16.6 multiple here. We get a nice target sell price of $662.67. So it trades at a forward multiple of about 10.5. So I think it's an intriguing company. I mean, my concern is it is, again, at a now 52-week high. It might be at an all-time high, if I'm not mistaken, unless we go back a long time, unless they had some issues in the financial crisis and peaked out there. I'm trying to pull up a chart.
It looks like it is at an all-time high.
It is at an all-time high. Yeah. So, I mean, Goldman is doing well. I know that they've had kind of a little bit more push into consumer banking. They have their, I think it's called Marcus, where they're trying to capture more of the consumer deposits. So it seems like they're trying to diversify a little bit of their revenue, but I think their big money maker should definitely start to pick up here. I think this year, next year, I mean, I wouldn't be surprised considering the strength in the stock market last year and even so far this year. Generally, IPOs will come out when the markets are hot.
And that is kind of a tricky one because you're right. I think things could start to work out for Goldman as far as the revenue and earnings go, but it's always a little scary buying something when it's at a peak.
Yeah, and it's always a little bit like, I don't know. I mean, the valuations are there, but you know, I kind of talked about this with Boeing last week where the cyclicality of the earnings and the length of contracts with Boeing, it's so hard to actually understand and analyze and try and essentially implement the model that we do with looking at valuing the earnings going forward, where, you know, if earnings can go from, let's say, and this isn't Goldman, but let's just say it for illustration purposes, earnings can go from $10 one year to, you know, $12 the next year, and then the following year fall down to $5 because of a different business cycle, it makes it very hard to value those types of companies. And, you know, I'm kind of just speculating here with Goldman, but I would assume that would be the case based off of their investment banking model, that their earnings should just have such large variability based off how that investment banking business is doing.
Oh, yeah. I bet if you look back the past 5 years, it's been all over the place as far as where their earnings have been.
Yeah. And if I was looking at buying the stock, I would definitely want to understand that to see how variable their earnings are, because that could totally make you look at saying the earnings are very attractive if they're trading at 10, but just again, make it simple. All of a sudden, their earnings get cut in half. Well, now that multiple was 20. So you have to understand how the multiple can change very quickly in businesses where the earnings can be so variable. So a little bit more of a complicated business to buy. Frankly, I'm a larger fan of the big money center banks that do have kind of investment banking within them, because I think you're going to get a little bit more stability. You might not get as large of a return in certain time periods, but I think the stability is definitely something that I prefer as an investor there. It looks like I do have time to cover one more company. I was actually going to look at, you know, technology is always kind of a hot sector. Palantir is one that it's gotten a lot of attention. I think their CEO is an interesting guy. I believe he's the founder of it as well. So let's take a quick look here at Palantir. Their ticker symbol is PLTR. Short percent, 4.3%, a little bit higher than I anticipated for a tech software company. Oh my gosh, wow. Price to earnings, 253, industry average, 44.7. Price to sales, 23.3. The industry average here, 9.4. Price to tangible book value, 14.3. Industry average here is 11. Price to cash flow, 72.5. Industry average here, 28. So, I mean, all these valuations are very, very expensive. Looking at the growth over the last year, earnings, it shows not material, but sales were up 12%. Frankly, for those types of valuations, I would anticipate more than 12% sales growth, considering the lofty valuations. No dividend for Palantir at this time. Balance sheet, a lot of liquidity. 5.6 is their current ratio. So they have tons, I would assume, of cash on the balance sheet. Debt to equity, not much debt, just 0.1. I see the company is profitable. Nice margin here, 9.4%. Return on equity, 6%. And the return on invested capital, 2.8. I see the current price for Palantir, $22.52. The 52-week high, $27.50. So not quite there. They hit that in March 7th of this year, but well off the 52-week low of $7.28. I'm not sure. Do you have the stock pulled up, Harrison, to see what was the high that they hit? I know they're still well off of that.
They hit a high, looks like, in the first part of 2021. It was at about $35 a share, which... Right now it's at 22, 23, so it's still down about 35% since then.
Yeah, our target sell price on it would be $6.64, so definitely not what we're looking for. But thank you for listening to the Smart Investing Show. It is for informational purposes only and should not be used as investment advice. If you would like to discuss in more detail your investment needs or have other investment questions, feel free to call myself Chase Wilsey or Brent Wilsey at 858-224-0004. Please visit our website at smartinvesting2000.com. That's smartinvesting2000.com. And for more daily educational information along with investment tips, go to our Facebook group, Smart Investing with Brent and Chase Wilsey. Today, I did all that. And may I say,